As I said, once we have coup d'etat, then we have death. Once we say no to coup d'etat, then we say yes to life. And we have the responsibility of protecting the life of every single citizen. I'm proud to be Haitian. I'm glad to see how many Haitians understand about the necessity of moving towards life and rejecting coup d'etat. Clearly, some others need to keep thinking about that direction, and I encourage them because this is what we need. And I may add, what we will have for the coming 6 months, elections to renew our parliament, will mean life instead of coup d'etat. Dialogue, compromise, elections, that's what we need. Thank you. Ecology.
Haiti, 2004. President Jean-Bertrand Aristide addresses the nation during a time of intense civil unrest, pleading for peace. Political gridlock with the small but powerful opposition movement, coupled with years of economic collapse thanks to a foreign aid embargo, have ignited parts of the country into open rebellion. Within months, armed gangs will seize control of the country's fourth largest city, and paramilitary forces will stream from the border with the Dominican Republic to conquer much of northern Haiti. By the summer, Jean-Bertrand Aristide will be forced to leave the country. Aristide began his political career as the country's first elected leader in modern history. He began as a radical priest from the slums of Port-au-Prince, who led a movement of Haiti's poor and destitute to topple the country's decades-long far-right dictatorship in 1990. Within months, a military coup would unseat him from office, before Aristide returned in 1994. Now, 10 years later, Jean-Bertrand Aristide is facing the threat of a second coup d'etat. To hear it from most news sources in the United States, it's because Aristide has rejected his democratic past for authoritarian rule, leading his country into despair and ruin. But Aristide was elected 2 times by overwhelming margins. By this point, he still remains the most popular politician in the country. So why is he fighting off a rebellion? The answer? A conscious, dedicated effort from Haiti's small ruling class and the United States to unseat Aristide from power and to destroy the political movement that put him there. This is a conspiracy you can believe in. Today's episode is about Haiti. It's the most populous country in the Caribbean, and the oldest republic in the Western Hemisphere after the United States, winning its freedom in the largest and most successful slave revolt in world history. But most of what the average person in the U.S. might know about Haiti is what we get from the news, a story of deep, cyclical poverty and endless political instability, but with no real explanation for why it is that way, or what or who is causing Haiti's problems. I wanted to do this episode after reading news stories about the murder of former Haitian President Jovenel Moïse last month, and after seeing how our own government in the United States reacted to the thousands of Haitians who have been attempting to exercise their right to seek asylum in the United States. But instead of digging into a sensational story about a yet unsolved presidential assassination, I wanted to go back a decade or two and talk about what happened and what was done to Haiti's first democratically elected leader in modern history, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Aristide was not assassinated. In fact, he's still alive today and recently returned to Haiti. But his government was undermined and he was ousted from power twice in less than 15 years. Why did this happen and how? For millions of Haitians, Aristide represented a hope to turn their nation around, to shake off the weight of centuries of debt to foreign countries, and a chance at creating a proud future for themselves. Jean-Bertrand Aristide was for and from a mass movement of Haiti's poor, a movement called Lavalasse, a Haitian Creole word meaning unstoppable flood. The flood carried Aristide, a small, unassuming parish priest from a poor neighborhood of Port-au-Prince, and voted him into the presidency of Haiti twice. And twice, he was removed. As we'll hear, the United States played a hand in taking him down, especially the second time. My sources for this episode include a book called Damning the Flood, Haiti and the Politics of Containment by Peter Hallward. The author, like me, clearly has a strong bias for Aristide, but it's extensively researched and much of it is based on interviews with Haitian people from the Lavalasse movement who experienced the events surrounding the coup firsthand. For historical background, I turn back to a book that I read years ago that I enjoy a lot, and that's The Black Jacobins by the Afro-Trinidadian historian C.L.R. James. It's pretty much the definitive history of the Haitian Revolution in English. It's an important event that I believe deserves much more attention in the United States. I should note here, I don't speak French, I don't speak Creole, so I apologize if I get any names wrong. I'm also not an expert. I just do this as a hobby, so feel free to look at my sources or some of your own sources for more research. Just take me with a grain of salt. We'll also be discussing some events that are a little traumatic. We're going to be talking about slavery, sexual assault, murder, and a civil war. So if that's not something you're comfortable listening to right now, I won't blame you if you hit stop. That said, even though we're mostly discussing events at the end of the 20th century and at the beginning of the 21st, let's start with the 18th, because it's important to have the context of the Haitian Revolution for this episode. In the 18th century, Haiti wasn't called Haiti. It was a French colony in the Caribbean called Saint-Domingue. This bit of land, occupying the western third of the island of Hispaniola, was the richest colony in the world. At least, it was the richest colony if you were one of the few whites who owned or ran the colony. As you might have guessed by now, this European colony in the Caribbean was run entirely on slave labor. It's true that Saint-Domingue was wealthy. It was the crown jewel of the French colonial empire, responsible for a significant portion of France's budget. It produced most of the coffee consumed in Europe and nearly half of the sugar. And it was these cash crops, especially the sugar, that brought in the most money. Sugar requires intensive, back-breaking labor to produce. You don't just have to grow the cane and harvest it, but process the cane, break it apart, feed it into a mill, boil it down so it can be transported for sale. Each plantation was like its own enclosed sugar factory, and factories require a large workforce. The French brought hundreds of thousands of slaves from Africa to work these coffee and sugar plantations in Saint-Domingue, to the point where the vast majority of the population of the colony were enslaved. And for over 100 years, the entire society of what would be Haiti was structured around human enslavement. Growing and harvesting sugarcane is dangerous, grueling work, and the slave drivers of Saint-Domingue resorted to brutal lengths to force people to do it. Because the white population lived in fear of a mass uprising, torture was commonplace in the colony as a deterrent to insubordination. Overseers or owners would have slaves beaten and whipped, but also subjected to monstrous treatment, like being thrown into boiling water, or being covered in honey and buried alive under anthills. All of this was in retribution for real or perceived challenges to the authority of white slaveholders. And this is to say nothing of the everyday accidents that could happen on the job, such as death from overwork or limbs being caught in the gears of a sugar mill. And it was true in every slaveholding society, sexual violence against enslaved women was commonplace. Slaves in Saint-Domingue were seen as expendable. It's true that Saint-Domingue was the richest colony on the planet, but for the vast majority of its population, it was hell on earth. That system would be overthrown in the Haitian Revolution. The Haitian Revolution is a little complicated, since it was not one singular conflict, but rather a series of conflicts with various combatants over a period of about 13 years. But I'll try to simplify it. During the early stages of the French Revolution, the First French Republic had not yet abolished the practice of slavery, and many whites in Saint-Domingue were supportive of the Republican cause. The upper 10% of Saint-Domingue consisted of whites, of course, but also a large population of free people of color, usually people of mixed European and African ancestry. And these free people of color could grow wealthy by becoming merchants or even slaveholders themselves. In 1789, the National Assembly in Paris extended full civil rights to white as well as black and mixed-race citizens of France and the colonies, provided that they were free and not slaves. This, of course, had very little meaning for the vast majority of the population of Saint-Domingue. But in 1791, as many wealthy planters feared would one day happen, the slaves revolted. A massive uprising of tens of thousands of slaves overwhelmed the northern province of the colony. And after enduring over a century of torture, rape, and murder at the hands of the planter class, the slaves reacted with fury, annihilating entire families of white slaveholders. In the South, another slave revolt rose up, setting fire to the cane fields as they marched towards the cities. Surprisingly, many of the revolt leaders at this point claimed allegiance to the king against the French Revolution, claiming they were fighting for their rights as French subjects. But this changed in 1793. After the National Assembly in France sent a new governor to the colony who sided with the rebelling slaves, both out of genuine hatred of slavery and because he correctly sensed that the white slave owners were seeking an alliance with the British forces who were now invading the colony. After the new French governor decreed the abolition of slavery, the leaders of the slave revolt would turn to the side of the French Revolution. One general who entered into this tenuous alliance with revolutionary France was Toussaint Louverture, a military genius who had been in the service of the Spanish. Toussaint was a former slave, and during the hostilities in Haiti, he developed a reputation as one of the most brilliant generals of the era. He became a prominent political figure in Saint-Domingue, and for some time, it appeared he may have become a popular leader of a free province within revolutionary France, if not for Napoleon. A few years after taking power, Napoleon Bonaparte sent an expedition to Saint-Domingue to reinstate the practice of slavery. The former slaves now found themselves fighting against the French in a war to preserve their own freedom and to declare independence. In 1802, Toussaint himself was captured and sent to Europe, where he died in prison. His chief lieutenant, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, took command. Unlike Toussaint, Dessalines did not have a habit of negotiating or giving mercy to his enemies. The freedmen defeated the French expedition, and Dessalines became the uncontested ruler of the new nation of Haiti. And what followed was a brutal, but perhaps after over a century of torture, expected extermination of the remaining white population of the former colony. White exiles from Haiti left in droves for France or Louisiana. The humiliation over losing their wealthy Caribbean plantations to former slaves, and the memory of Dessalines' massacres in retaliation, fed decades of anti-Haitian propaganda in France and the United States. Haiti became a pariah state. In 1825, the newly restored Kingdom of France forced Haiti to pay 150 million francs for the loss of their richest colony. It was a debt that Haiti dutifully paid, with interest, for the crime of liberating themselves from slavery. It was not fully settled until 1947. Haiti also accumulated a significant aid debt to the United States, a country that for much of the 19th century treated the Caribbean nation with open hostility for overthrowing its old slave society. In 1915, this debt was called in, as thousands of U.S. Marines invaded Haiti, fearing that political instability in the country could lead to a stoppage of debt payments back to Washington. The U.S. occupation lasted almost 20 years, and it left a long legacy. One thing the U.S. made sure to do for the Haitians was develop a strong, well-trained army, not for protecting the nation from invasion, but for protecting the small class of wealthy business leaders, politicians, and professionals in Haiti from the poor, that is to say, from the vast majority of the country. Class divisions in modern Haiti are stark. Average wages in the time Aristide was in office were only $1 to $2 a day, and that's for those lucky enough to have jobs in the clothing sweatshops that make up much of the country's small industrial base. In 2006, 55% of the country was living off the equivalent of 44 American cents per day. Most Haitians don't speak French regularly, but Creole, a language derived from French that uses different spelling and some grammar from West African languages. The small population of the rich, on the other hand, live in a completely different world. Many, though not all, are descended from the mixed-race free people of color. They often speak French or learn English, the languages of international diplomacy and trade, which is important because this small segment of the population traditionally made up the political and economic leadership of the country. A small group of families dominate the business, political, and media world of Haiti, and a slightly larger, but statistically small class of upper-middle-class professionals send their children overseas to the U.S., France, or Quebec for school. Much of the Haitian elite established non-governmental organizations, NGOs, to direct public policy or as a source of income. This is a big deal in a country where 70% of the operating budget comes from foreign aid and loans. The politics of the country's elite throughout the 20th century were driven through fear. Fear of popular uprising. Fear of the vast majority of the population who did not live in hilltop suburbs, who did not have servants, and who often did not even have running water or electricity in their homes. Against this mass of people, the Haitian ruling class set the army. In their paranoia, they stockpiled rifles and high-powered weaponry. And to defend their interests, they backed far-right dictators like the Duvalier family. François Duvalier, often called Papa Doc, became president of Haiti in 1957. He was a respected doctor who treated infectious diseases, and was first thought to be a populist with an affinity for the country's majority black population. But he quickly became a dictator, adopting a staunch anti-communism that earned him an arm's-length alliance with the U.S., and establishing a death squad to root out dissent, real or imagined, throughout Haiti. The members of this paramilitary force were known as Tonton Macout, after a traditional Haitian boogeyman. The hated Macouts were responsible for countless murders, abductions, and human rights abuses against suspected opponents to the regime. This practice was continued under Papa Doc's son, Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier, who reformed the Tonton Macout into a special forces unit under the army. But the human rights abuses were the same as before. Against this brutal dictatorship that passed from father to son stood the masses of poor Haitians, the majority of the population. and much of the liberal section of the country's small ruling class joined them. So who is Jean-Bertrand Aristide? Well, like the majority of his country and his followers, he grew up poor. Aristide is a black man from the slums of Port-au-Prince and showed promise as a young child. He was a brilliant student. So as a young boy, the Salesian order of priests took him in and trained him for the Catholic priesthood. He served as the parish priest of St. John Bosco in Port-au-Prince, celebrating Mass with the poor of his home city. It was parishes like these that formed the nucleus of organized political dissent against the Duvalier regime. It may surprise some to hear that Catholic parishes in Haiti were organizing centers for what was a left-wing populist movement. The upper hierarchy of the church during the Cold War was decidedly anti-communist and right-wing. But for those listeners who weren't raised Catholic, let me take a minute to explain what liberation theology is. Liberation theology is a political and religious movement that thrived in Latin America throughout the 1980s. It usually flourished in countries where a far-right or military dictatorship ruled over people who were overwhelmingly poor, had few rights, and were threatened with deadly force if they organized unions or protests against the repression. The masses in these countries were also often quite religious, and the parish priests and sometimes bishops who tended to these flocks started to echo the concerns of their parishioners. Liberation theology places the needs of peasants and workers above those of the rich and powerful. It says that the poor deserve the ability to organize and advocate for themselves. It was in this tradition, the message that the Lord hears the cry of the poor, that drove Jean-Bertrand Aristide and other priests of the early Lavalas movement to speak out against the Duvalier regime. And it's ultimately what forced Baby Doc Duvalier to flee the country, as a popular movement threatened his grip on power. Unfortunately, a series of military coups followed Duvalier's departure in 1986. That didn't stop Father Aristide and his followers, who constantly agitated for democracy and revolutionary change in the political system in Haiti. Now, it should be noted that Aristide was always a proponent of non-violent revolution. In a country where the upper class had private security forces, control of the army, and stockpiles of automatic and semi-automatic weapons, it would be suicide to send masses of his supporters armed with rusty pistols and machetes to overthrow the government. He stressed to his followers to act peacefully and build coalitions, but to defend themselves if necessary. He had good reason for telling them this. In September of 1988, Father Aristide was celebrating morning mass in his parish church of St. John Bosco. Over 1,000 parishioners were gathered there. The church was then suddenly and violently attacked by assailants with guns and machetes who were screaming, "Communists! Communists!" attempting to kill Aristide himself. The church was then set on fire, and dozens were murdered, with 77 people being sent to the hospital with serious injuries. The perpetrators would go on to hunt down anyone they believed was present at the mass that day, even invading a labor and delivery ward at a nearby hospital looking for victims. The community eventually recognized these attackers as former Tonton Macoute, members of Duvalier's feared death squad. Some of the men responsible for the attack on St. John Bosco Church were found and burned to death in the streets of Port-au-Prince. It was vigilante acts such as these, admittedly brutal actions, but ones made in retaliation to the murder of civilians and arguably actions made in a state of war, that led Aristide's detractors to accuse him of fomenting mob violence. Although Aristide never ordered his followers to carry out random violent attacks, it was a canard that stuck with him for his entire political career. His political career began in earnest in 1990, when he was swept into office by a mandate of nearly 70% of the vote as president of Haiti. It was likely the first fair election in Haiti's long history. And although at the time, Aristide was not exactly thirsty for power, he was the natural leader of the pro-democracy movement. His fame spread overseas, earning him a positive reputation in the United States as the Nelson Mandela of Haiti. Even though Aristide had a clear mandate to dramatically reform the country, he knew that he couldn't come right out of the gate for a total social revolution. For one, he had to contend with the army, which had only a few months before been violently suppressing the democratic movement. Aristide quickly began by removing military officers with the worst human rights records and the strongest ties to the Makut. And he also got rid of the hated section chief system. This was a Duvalier-era policy of allowing a political underboss to keep order in a district of the country, and their pay was whatever they could extort out of the local population. Still, these moderate changes to the armed forces immediately enraged the army, and Aristide faced his first coup attempt in January of 1991. This was before he even had a chance to hold his inauguration. Roger Lafontaine, a former Tonton Macoute, occupied the National Palace of Haiti on the 6th of January, and then declared himself president. Tens of thousands of people quickly took to the streets of Port-au-Prince, surrounding the palace and forcing Lafontaine to back down within a matter of hours. Aristide would take his rightful spot as the elected president a month later, but this would not be the only coup attempt he would face. The other potential danger that Aristide had to deal with was the power that installed and trained Haiti's modern army in the first place. That's the United States. Although Washington seemed willing to allow Aristide to take power, after all, he was the clear winner of the election by a wide margin, the little priest was not the United States' preferred choice for Haiti's president. In the 1990 election, the United States poured over $30 million into the campaign of Marc Bazin, a former official at the World Bank and a neoliberal economist. Bazin had the overwhelming support of the business community in Haiti, but it didn't do him much good. He won less than 15% of the vote, compared to Aristide's 67%. Even still, an American delegation led by former President Jimmy Carter tried to pressure Aristide to form a sort of coalition government with Marc Bazin by making him the prime minister. Aristide instead nominated someone from his own movement, a political ally named René Préval. It was risky for Aristide to stand up to the U.S. this way, because so much of Haiti's budget came from foreign aid, especially from the United States. And aid from the United States always comes with strings attached. USAID, or the United States Agency for International Development, had been heavily funding the military-backed regime in the late 1980s, in the hope of making Haiti a cheap investment zone for American business. But when Aristide introduced a modest increase of the minimum wage from 33 American cents an hour to 50 cents an hour, various nonprofits and think tanks and government agencies in the U.S. expressed concern. USAID even spent millions that year in funding Haitian businesses' campaigns agitating against that minimum wage increase. From the moment he got into office, even before if you count the coup attempt that took place in January, President Aristide's hold on power was in jeopardy. After months of coup attempts, violence against his supporters from former Tonton Macoutes, and the small community of wealthy business leaders openly backing the military against his government, Aristide delivered a controversial speech on September 27, 1991. Aristide denounced the undemocratic elite and their plots to undermine the new government, veering on language that his critics claimed were an endorsement of vigilante violence by burning opponents in the street. Referring to Haiti's business and military elite, Aristide said, "You earned your money through thievery under an evil regime. It is not really yours," he told the crowd. Quote, "Whenever you were hungry, turn your eyes in the direction of people who are not hungry. Whenever you are out of work, turn your eyes in the direction of those who can put people to work. Ask them why not. What are you waiting for? Aristide then turned his anger to the Tonton Macoute, the death squads that terrorized the people of Haiti during the Duvalier regime, and who now threatened to overthrow the government. He told the crowd, if they find a Macoute, quote, do not hesitate to give him what he deserves. Now, Aristide's supporters had long claimed that this was a call to self-defense, not simply random acts of violence and murder. The Macoutes had long killed and tortured civilians with impunity, and now they and their allies were close to toppling the first democratic government in the country's modern history. It's possible Aristide sensed another coup was coming, because 3 days later, on September 30, 1991, he was abducted and forced into exile. Army General Raoul Cedras effectively took full control of Haiti. He learned from the mistakes of the first failed coup attempt by making sure to position the military at key choke points in Port-au-Prince first. The soldiers who participated were paid up to $5,000 each, most of it coming from funds raised by elite families in the Haitian business world. In the first night of the coup, these soldiers would wage open war on the people of Port-au-Prince, shooting hundreds. They killed over 250 in the pro-Aristide slum of Cité Soleil alone in one night. Killings from the military and associated paramilitary gangs would rise for the next 3 years as the Haitian army tried to root out supporters of the deposed president. Hundreds of thousands of Haitians would flee the country or attempt to flee to the United States. And the reaction from the United States to the 1991 coup is key here. Publicly, George H.W. Bush's administration denounced the sudden military takeover of a democratically elected government. But they would not do anything to assist Aristide, or even admit that he could one day return to power. After the military government was deposed years later, the United States ensured that key figures behind the coup, including Raoul Cedras himself, were allowed to escape punishment and retire safely overseas. I should note here that General Raoul Cedras received training at the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia. And it may have been true that the Bush administration outright preferred the coup government over Aristide. One CIA official testified to Congress just a few months after the coup that Cedras was part of, quote, the most promising group of leaders in Haiti. And he also claimed there is no evidence that he was leading an oppressive regime. This was, of course, a lie. And the CIA knew full well that the Cedras regime was oppressive, because many of the people involved were their employees. The country's national police chief, Michel Francois, helped Cedras carry out the coup, and he wielded significant influence in the military regime. Francois was also a longtime CIA asset. In fact, he had a small army of former or current CIA assets at his command. You see, in 1987, CIA station chief Donald Terry worked with the Haitian army to establish the National Intelligence Service, or SIN. Officially, SIN was intended to bring in drug traffickers. Haiti is something of a gateway for cocaine smuggling from Colombia to the U.S. But in reality, SIN mostly spied on, intimidated, or killed dissidents. SIN operatives also engaged in drug trafficking themselves. Now, I'm sure it's just a weird coincidence that wherever there was a CIA presence in Latin America in the 80s, they worked with people who were smuggling massive amounts of cocaine. What all of this meant was that there was a large military apparatus in Haiti with very close ties to the CIA. And after Aristide was pushed out by the Haitian military in 1991, this network of paid informants, or SIN operatives, were able to claw their way back to the top. One of those former SIN operatives was a man named Emmanuel Toto Constant. Toto Constant began receiving monthly payments from the CIA in 1991 to establish a resistance movement to Aristide, just in case the new president proved to be a little too radical for the U.S.'s taste. What Constant used that CIA money for was establishing one of the most ruthless and deadly paramilitary forces in Haiti's history. The group was called, in English, the Revolutionary Front for Haitian Advancement and Progress, or FRAPH in the French acronym, pronounced FROP. Although officially the U.S. had an embargo on the regime, National Police Chief, and remember, CIA asset, Michel Francois was able to source military-grade weapons and machine guns from his brother in Miami. Pretty soon, Toto Constant had a modern, well-equipped private army, and he used it to carry out a campaign of terror on Aristide's base of support. In the later years of the coup government, FROP was venturing out into the slums throughout the country to murder suspected Lavalas supporters on an almost nightly basis. One of the deadliest attacks was in the city of Gonaïves, where FROP militants ransacked the Rabateau shantytown at dawn and then gunned down fleeing civilians as they tried to run for safety. Dozens were murdered. By 1994, FROP was well on its way to becoming the most powerful, well-armed military force in Haiti, and that was all thanks to the CIA. Back in the United States, there was a new administration, though not much had changed in its Haiti policy. Bill Clinton made a campaign promise during the 1992 election to return Aristide to power, and he was facing pressure to make good on it from demonstrations of Haitian Americans and public advocacy for Aristide from African American political leaders. But even though Clinton did eventually return Aristide to the presidency of Haiti, he made sure to do it on the U.S.'s terms. In order to return, Aristide was forced to negotiate not just with the U.S., but the very generals who deposed him. The U.S. made Aristide accept amnesty to key leaders of the coup, and once again, they pressured him to select a pro-business and pro-U.S. politician as his prime minister. It wasn't Marc Bazin this time. He was busy in Haiti collaborating with the military regime. Aristide was also forced to sign on to a neoliberal economic plan that went against everything he stood for. It was a structural adjustment program called the Paris Plan. In exchange for a desperately needed $770 million aid and loan package, his government would have to freeze wages, cut the civil service by half, and privatize what few government-run industries existed in Haiti, such as the state bank, utilities, and the airport. Aristide's critics on the left would point to this agreement as a betrayal, as proof that Aristide came back from the United States as a changed man, hungry for power at all costs. But it's important to put the deal that he made with the U.S. in context. Number one, he didn't have much of a choice. Haiti at the time had a 70% unemployment rate, and the majority of its operating budget came from foreign aid. Aristide himself said, it was, quote, a choice between death and death. Either we enter a global economic system in which we know we cannot survive, or we refuse and face death by slow starvation. The second thing to remember is that at this time, the situation in Haiti is dire and getting worse. FROP is gunning down civilians daily. Aristide, who was elected by a vast majority of the country, is the best shot at providing some sense of unity and stability. But he has to get back as soon as he can, before FROP becomes too powerful. And the third thing, Aristide was actually able to bargain the Americans down. Yes, he had to go against his own principles and accept an economic plan of mass privatization and low wages. But he did so on the condition that the $770 million in aid would be primarily invested in government-run public health, literacy, and rural school programs. Aristide was finally reinstated as president in 1994 as part of a U.S. military operation. Aristide's supporters, most of the country, welcomed his return. Although many felt that the American military presence was far too lenient with FROP, which was still causing havoc throughout the country. In fact, one of the first things that the American troops did when they landed in Haiti was secure nearly 200,000 pages of classified documents from FROP headquarters. The U.S. never even attempted to disarm this paramilitary force, which would go on to have dire consequences for democracy in Haiti a few years later. Prominent leaders of FROP, like Toto Constant, were allowed to walk free out of the country and live comfortable lives in exile in the United States. Personally, knowing what we know about the second coup against Aristide, I think the CIA was keeping FROP around as a contingency plan again in case Aristide got too radical. Aristide could ill afford to increase tension with the United States. In April of 1995, he abolished the army altogether, replacing it with a national police under civilian control. The army, long hated by ordinary Haitians for decades anyway, had completely destroyed any credibility after the 1991 coup. Still, Clinton tried to talk Aristide down into simply vastly reducing the size of the military, but political pressure from Lavalas was strongly in favor of completely getting rid of the armed forces altogether. One Lavalas supporter who spoke to reporters in 1995 said, quote, "Before the foreigners leave, they have to destroy the army. Every night they break into our homes and rape our daughters and wives. Don't leave any of them." Although Aristide was boxed in by the economic mandates of the Paris Plan and straddled with the difficult task of cleaning up the country after 3 years of disastrous military rule, the U.S. still tried to push for even more control over the country. Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbot said in a briefing, quote, "Even after our military exit in February 1996, we will remain in charge by means of U.S. aid and the private sector." Now, as an aside, this surprisingly frank statement from Strobe Talbot is important because, as we'll see, nonprofits and NGOs in Haiti sometimes serve a dual purpose. Of course, many of them provide much-needed aid, food, medical care, clean water, buildings, or they deliver reports on human rights violations and corruption. But we should remember that these are usually private institutions, run for Haiti's poor majority, but usually not by or with them. During Aristide's terms in office, many of these NGOs were often run by wealthier exiles or business people or foreigners and received funding from USAID or think tanks with close ties to the U.S. government. It doesn't mean that aid or reporting human rights abuse is bad, but the funding and class politics of NGOs are just something to keep in mind. One way that Aristide was hemmed in by pressures from the United States and the international community was over the issue of when exactly he should step down from office. From the beginning, Aristide promised to serve 1 5-year term before handing power to someone else. But the question remained, what years are we counting here? Remember, he was only in office for a few months before he was thrown out in a military coup. Most voters in Haiti just assumed he was going to serve out the remaining 4.5 years of his term after he got back. But the U.S. and the international community were not going to allow that. A 5-year term means 5 years, even if 3 of those years are actually spent in exile because you got overthrown by a bunch of CIA-funded coke dealers. Because Haiti relied so much on foreign aid to keep afloat, and because much of that aid is offered conditionally, Aristide reluctantly agreed to step down in 1996 and support his former prime minister, René Préval, for president. With Aristide's backing, René Préval won the presidency. Over the next few years, Préval would continue most of Aristide's policy of providing as many social programs for the urban and rural poor as he could, while trying to mitigate the effects of privatization and austerity demanded by the U.S. and international lenders. But class tensions had been building within the Lavalas movement, and they now threatened to fracture the organization. A wealthier, more centrist wing of Lavalas had closer ties to the political and business community. And they weren't as opposed to the demands of neoliberal market reforms as most of Aristide's supporters were. Now, opposed to this wing were the majority of the Lavalas movement, the poor. Even though he was forced to make a bargain with global capital, Aristide and his successor still enjoyed this wing's support. Both his and Préval's government instituted successful school building and clinic building programs and adult literacy campaigns all throughout the country. Plus, he did get rid of the army. This left-wing populist current and the Lavalas movement split off and founded its own organization, Famille Lavalas, or Family of the Flood. It would become, briefly, the most powerful and most popular party in the country. But not under René Préval's term. The party split meant that Parliament was under control of the centrist wing of the Lavalas movement, now called Organization for Struggling People, or OPL in the French acronym. When new parliamentary elections in 1997 gave a huge victory to Famille Lavalas, the pro-Aristide wing, OPL just refused to recognize the results, and they remained in the legislature. The government was then in gridlock, and Préval was compelled to govern by decree until new legislative elections in 2000. Famille Lavalas easily won those too. But this is where things start to get really troubling for Jean-Bertrand Aristide. If no candidate in a Haitian election gets over 50% of the vote in the first round, it's meant to go to a second round. Now, the way that elections had been run in Haiti up to this point, only the votes towards the top four candidates are counted towards the percentage of this round, which is what Haiti did in 2000, giving several open Senate seats to Famille Lavalas. But even though Haiti had run all of the previous elections that decade in this way with no complaint, the Organization of American States, an international organization based in Washington, now claimed that this process was flawed. The small yet wealthy opposition pounced on that opportunity. They decided to boycott the upcoming presidential election that fall, an election that Aristide was running in and widely expected to win. He did, despite that boycott, by over 90%. Some American news outlets echoed the opposition's claims that the voting was fraudulent and that turnout was only 10%. But that doesn't seem to be the case. Despite challenges from broken infrastructure, a shoestring budget, and an active right-wing paramilitary force in the country, independent observers in Haiti place voter participation in that election at around 60% of eligible voters. Aristide, once again, had a clear mandate. But that wasn't enough for the opposition, or the United States. Agreeing with the OAS and the Haitian opposition claim that the 2000 elections were fraudulent, the United States subjected Haiti to an aid embargo, and they cut off an expected loan from the Inter-American Development Bank until Aristide came to terms with the opposition. Now remember, aid amounted to about 70% of Haiti's operating budget in a given year, so having these hundreds of millions of dollars held back meant that schools would not be built, roads would not be repaired, clinics could not be stocked, and everyday people could die. Thanks to the embargo, the forced political instability, and other economic assaults, Haiti's GDP fell from $4 billion in 1999 to $2.9 billion in 2003. Now let's talk about the political instability. Because while American organizations like USAID were cutting off money to the Haitian government, they weren't cutting it off to nonprofits run by Aristide's opponents, or to NGOs that were fully under American control. This helped support an organized opposition that united the center-left from OPL that split from Lavalas with far-right collaborators of the old military and Duvalier regimes. They were strange bedfellows, but what they had in common was this. They were largely from, or represented the interests of, Haiti's educated middle class and the wealthy elite. This is a small minority of the country. And they came together at the right time. Because in the United States, George W. Bush was just about to take office. If Bill Clinton's attitude towards Aristide was to publicly support him and privately undermine his government at every opportunity, Bush's approach would be to just destroy his government out in public. The political opposition in Haiti formed two organized groups, Democratic Convergence, a catch-all party for the center and the far right who opposed Aristide, and Group 184, referring to the number of businesses, pro-American evangelical churches, and nonprofits that were united in the organization. Both of these organizations received large amounts of money from some of Haiti's wealthiest families, and both received funding and training from a group in Washington called the International Republican Institute, or IRI. The IRI is officially a nonprofit unaffiliated with the government of the United States. But in Haiti, at this time, it was explicitly carrying out the wishes of the U.S. State Department, and in fact, they do get some funding from the U.S. government. Although they don't admit it, the IRI is also associated with the Republican Party in the United States. John McCain was their chairman for about 25 years or so. And since 1998, they had been consulting with former Duvalierists who opposed Aristide. In 2000, the IRI helped create Democratic Convergence and then advised them on their negotiations with Aristide. Staring down a devastating aid embargo, Aristide decided to negotiate, and he caved. The opposition wanted new legislative elections? Fine, we'll do it. Lavalas will win anyway. The Convergence, even though they brought this specific demand, then walked away from the table. Oh, they want a majority on the country's electoral commission too? Fine, Aristide offered that. The opposition refused and upped the ante again. Now, they wanted Aristide to appoint a prime minister of their choosing, who would be allowed to govern by decree, and they wanted the president to replace himself with a three-person commission. Now keep in mind, Aristide just won an election by over 90% of the vote. This strategy of making increasingly ridiculous demands and then backing away from the table once Aristide gave them what they wanted caused political chaos. That's because the necessary foreign aid package from the U.S. was contingent on Aristide making a deal with the opposition. Democratic Convergence developed this strategy with help from the IRI. Also consulting with the opposition in Haiti was Roger Noriega, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for the Western Hemisphere. Noriega had recently served in the staff of North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms, a man who held an obsessive hatred for Aristide ever since the radical priest was first elected. Aristide was due for inauguration in February of 2001. But Democratic Convergence, a group that didn't even participate in the elections, decided to hold a rival inauguration of their own president that same month, and then they set up their own parallel government. For the next 3 years, Aristide's government, the elected one, would be frequently blocked by the opposition, which represented the interests of less than 10% of Haiti's people, and an opposition that was funded and directed by an American nonprofit with government ties. In his second term, many of the articles or TV news reports on Haiti in the American or European press were quite negative. His country was experiencing extreme poverty and instability. That's true. They were under an aid embargo from the most powerful country on earth. The president's refusal to give in to every single demand of the unelected opposition would lead outlets like the Washington Post, The Economist, or the New York Times to call his government authoritarian. Even left-leaning or liberal outlets were claiming that, although Aristide once offered hope for democracy in Haiti, he betrayed his movement by acting like a dictator. In fact, these outlets were occasionally repeating stories that they heard in the Haitian press, which by and large was owned and operated by wealthy families who opposed Aristide. André Appéd, a wealthy industrialist who would go on to fund right-wing paramilitaries to overthrow the government, ran the country's main cable network. And the Boulos family, also from Haiti's elite, operated radio stations and newspapers that published nonstop propaganda against Aristide. This anti-Aristide content, some of it outright invented, some of it taken out of important context, would be picked up by major news wires like Reuters or the AP, giving these stories from explicitly anti-Lavalas sources a veneer of credibility. If you just say that Aristide, who, by the way, won two different elections with overwhelming margins of victory, is a dictator long enough, well, eventually, people are going to start to believe Aristide is a dictator. There is a surprising exception to these voices in the West about Aristide, and that came from Harvard economist Jeffrey Sachs. If you listen to my episode about Boris Yeltsin, Sachs was one of the Americans advising the Russian president to swiftly privatize his economy. So he's not exactly a strong critic of the Washington consensus. But in an article published in 2004, Sachs summed up how the political crisis was mostly a result of foreign interference. Quote, "By saying that aid would be frozen until Aristide and the political opposition reached an agreement, the Bush administration provided Haiti's unelected opposition with an open-ended veto. Aristide's foes merely had to refuse to bargain to plunge Haiti into chaos. The chaos has now come." To say that the chaos in Haiti in the early 2000s was largely the fault of the U.S. aid embargo is not to say that Jean-Bertrand Aristide never made any mistakes. First, there was a problem of corruption, especially in the national police force that Aristide created to replace the army. The brief U.S. occupation in the mid-90s was in charge of creating this new police force, and that meant that the leadership of the national police were drawn from the old military, or from the expansive web of paid CIA assets in Haiti. This cohort was hostile to Aristide, and it was often difficult for the president to exact control over the police. Drug trafficking, extortion, bribery, and police brutality were common, but not nearly as common as under the military regime or Duvalier. In total, human rights groups like Amnesty International were only able to attribute about 30 political killings to Aristide's government, mostly from the police force who he sometimes struggled to control. For context, the military regime under Cedras killed over 4,000 in only 3 years, while Papadoc and Baby Doc Duvalier were directly responsible for at least 50,000 murders. And as Lavalas evolved from a big tent political movement to an organized party, it naturally brought in some opportunists who used the movement for personal gain. Although he was never credibly accused of corruption personally, Aristide was too trusting of longtime comrades who began to take kickbacks and bribes and took part in drug trafficking. One example is Senator Danny Toussaint, who was even linked to the murder of a popular left-wing journalist named Jean Dominique. Toussaint would later break with Aristide and become a chief political rival. Left-wing critics of Aristide also cited his devil's bargain that he made with the United States. This included the Paris Plan that required the privatization of much of the state industries and the later readjustment plan he entered into with the IMF, plus free trade zones on the border of the Dominican Republic that compelled the government to oppose unionization efforts there. I'm sympathetic to those critiques, but Haiti was and is in a particularly difficult position when it comes to negotiations with the U.S. or IMF. They rely mostly on foreign aid, and in the 90s, the country was facing an impending takeover from FROP, the far-right mercenary group armed by the CIA. Aristide bargained to include social programs for the poor as part of the Paris Plan that he cut with the U.S. But I agree that he didn't have much room to maneuver. He did what he could to mitigate the fire sale of Haitian assets to American companies. And it's hard to argue that the U.S. thought he was an accomplice here, based on how we treated him. The problems in Haiti under Aristide were problems of a democracy emerging after decades of dictatorship. Yes, there was corruption, especially in law enforcement and the legal system. But these were issues generations in the making, and the government had few resources to fix them. But still, Aristide was the most popular politician in the country, even through the chaotic years of his second term, when the economy collapsed under the U.S. aid embargo. Gallup polls conducted in the country in 2002 showed that 60% of the country still picked Aristide as Haiti's most trusted leader, while less than 4% picked the public face of Democratic Convergence. Even American and British news outlets admitted that if he ran again for re-election in 2005, he would almost certainly win. And why was that? Aristide and his successor, René Préval, knew they could not change the country overnight, or even in three presidential terms. What Aristide aimed for was, rather than having his people struggle to survive in one of the poorest countries in the world, was to live in a poverty with dignity. For his government, this meant extensive investment in education. There were 34 high schools in Haiti before Aristide took office. After his second administration, there were 104, with 195 new primary schools. Aristide and Préval's government also printed millions of booklets at hundreds of literacy centers across the country to teach adults how to read. Adult illiteracy fell by about 20% thanks to these efforts. Aristide built new clinics and hospitals, and a new medical school with support from Cuban doctors. He also introduced new programs to combat infectious diseases like HIV. Under both of his administrations, he introduced meaningful raises to the minimum wage. Special children's courts were established to protect the rights of restivex. Restivex are children from poor families sent to work as servants for rich families in exchange for food and education. Unfortunately, many of them are treated like child slaves. Aristide was the first president to attempt to protect their legal rights. The Lavalas movement was also a benefit to the millions of poor Haitians who participated. Rather than a cult of personality around the president, it was more of a decentralized movement with local clubs and affiliated organizations across the country that served as engines of activism. This movement formed a huge base of grassroots support for the president. It was also the first opportunity for real civic engagement for millions of poor Haitians who previously lived under military or dictatorial rule. The opposition, represented by Democratic Convergence and their benefactors in the IRI, had no similar base of support in the country. If they couldn't defeat Aristide at the ballot box, they'd have to resort to other means. The first armed operations carried against Aristide's government began in July of 2001, when Haitian commandos began pouring in from across the border with the Dominican Republic, attacking police stations and murdering civilian Lavalas activists and their families. These raids were led by a drug smuggler, former death squad leader and Haitian police chief named Guy Philippe. Guy Philippe was also a former officer in the Haitian army. When Aristide dissolved the army in 1995, the U.S. State Department and CIA helped push former Haitian army leaders back into the ranks of the National Police Force during the American occupation. Philippe was one of those officers that the U.S. shepherded into leadership. Just as the U.S. did after the 1915 invasion, the Americans were attempting to create a well-trained and equipped homegrown force to protect the interests of American investment and the ruling class of Haiti. But after the Haitian government removed Philippe from his post, he went into hiding in the Dominican Republic. This on its own is suspicious. At this time, the Dominican Republic was a dictatorship, and it had a long history of serving as a client state for the U.S. There was a long-standing U.S. intelligence presence in the Dominican Republic, and suddenly, just a year after seeking refuge there, Guy Philippe was storming back into Haiti with something called the Front for National Liberation and Reconstruction, in the French acronym FLRN. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Roger Noriega denied any involvement with Guy Philippe. So did the IRI, stating that Philippe was a known criminal. Democratic Convergence also distanced themselves from Philippe's army, and some of its chief members claimed that they had never even met him. But that's not what Guy Philippe said. According to the rebel leader himself, he began plotting an armed resistance to Aristide with members of Democratic Convergence in December 2000. Said Philippe, quote, "The Haitian elite and the political parties in the Convergence helped us with money and weapons. Some leading Haitian businessmen met with us. They donated $50,000 American. The businessmen seemed keen to help us at all costs. Getting hold of money was not a problem." The Democratic Convergence, and by proxy, the U.S. government, couldn't afford to have their relationship with someone like Philippe out in the open. The story they wanted to present to the outside world was that they were a democratic opposition fighting for civil rights under an authoritarian regime. So in 2001, they distanced themselves from Philippe and FLRN. They even went so far as to claim that these attacks that were being carried out were false flags from Aristide, served to whip up a frenzy against the opposition. Aristide's supporters apparently saw through this lie. When the FLRN assaulted the National Palace in a coup attempt in December of 2001, pro-Aristide mobs responded by burning down two headquarters of the Democratic Convergence. American news coverage typically portrayed these burnings as mob violence against a lawful opposition, encouraged by an authoritarian president. What they usually left out was that this was in response to a coup attempt carried out by what was, in effect, the paramilitary wing of Democratic Convergence. Criminal though he is, I'm inclined to believe Guy Philippe when he says he had a working relationship with Democratic Convergence. For one, during the time of the 2001 attacks, some armed rebels were publicly introducing themselves as the armed wing of the opposition. And by the time these forces began to gain momentum against the government in 2004, Democratic Convergence leaders switched from claiming that they wanted nothing to do with the rebels to calling them, quote, heroes. During the time of the FLRN raids in 2001 and 2002, the Bush administration repeated claims that these attacks were false flags orchestrated by Aristide himself. Roger Noriega called on Aristide to, quote, heal the wounds of the country after the assault on the National Palace, as if Aristide was attempting to coup himself. In the years following Aristide's removal from power, Guy Philippe would go on to speak openly to the press about who was backing him, even naming exact names of key opposition party leaders who he claims gave him direct orders for specific attacks. In 2007, the U.S. seemed to have had enough of Philippe speaking so openly. He was finally arrested on drug trafficking charges by the DEA. Meanwhile, on the domestic front, Aristide was looking to find another source of much-needed income for Haiti, and one that wouldn't come with the strings attached of foreign aid, reparations from France. What Aristide began to publicly demand in 2003 was not a lump sum for French slavery, although I think he would have been well within his rights to do so, but it was a specific calculation. His administration added up the modern equivalent of all the debt and interest Haiti was forced to pay to France from 1825 to 1947. If you remember, this so-called debt was intended to repay French slave owners for their lost property during the Haitian Revolution. According to Aristide's figures, the amount Haiti paid and was now owed by France was over $21 billion American. Needless to say, Aristide's pronouncement on French reparations was very popular in his home country, and it's conceivable that Haiti could have made a case for these repayments in the UN. It is true that they paid the equivalent of this vast sum over the course of a century, and it's also true that it harmed their country irreparably. But the response from French President Jacques Chirac's government in Paris was shock mixed with some vague threats. Said Chirac in September of 2003, quote, Before bringing up claims of this nature, I cannot stress enough to the authorities of Haiti the need to be very vigilant about, how should I put it, the nature of their actions and their regime. Statements from major parties of the right and center-left in France soon came out condemning Aristide as a dictator, while the French government began establishing closer ties to democratic convergence in Haiti, delivering coveted French visas and plane tickets to loyal supporters. By this time, in Haiti, late 2003, the paramilitary opposition to Aristide was also heating up. Since Haiti had no standing army, much of the armed conflict at this point happened between armed gangs that had some political affiliation to the government or the opposition. In the city of Gonaïves, a pro-Aristide group known as the Cannibal Army acted as a gang of vicious street toughs or local Robin Hoods, depending on who you asked. During a protracted conflict between the Cannibal Army and a rival gang associated with the opposition FLRN, the leader of the Cannibals, a man named Kuban Metayer, was found brutally murdered and mutilated. Metayer's brother accused Aristide of ordering the killing, and then teamed up with Jean Tatoun, a former FROP member, and realigned the Cannibal Army to the opposition against Aristide. Now, the accusation that Aristide ordered the killing of Metayer was repeated in the domestic and foreign press as if it was fact, but no proof of this has ever emerged. We still don't know who had Metayer killed, but I find it unlikely that Aristide had the leader of a pro-Lavalas gang killed. What would he gain from it? It's more likely that Metayer was killed over drugs, since that's the dangerous business that he was involved in. As Gonaïves became a foothold for the FLRN, similar disturbances were happening in the nearby city of Saint-Marc. A gang associated with the rebels had been killing Lavalas supporters and burning homes. By February 2004, they set fire to the local police station and a clinic, and they seemingly took control of the city. A pro-Lavalas gang worked with the police to fight the rebels off. Now, what happened next is still a point of contention. News reports at the time described the incident as a battle between a pro-rebel gang on one side and a pro-Lavalas gang and the national police on the other. In the firefight, 5 people were killed, and a dozen homes of the rebel gang members were burned in retaliation. But then a human rights nonprofit that received funding from USAID and the Canadian government referred to this battle as a, quote, genocide, in which 50 innocent people were killed, and they laid the blame for that at high-level officials in Aristide's government. Now, the author of Damning the Flood rejects this narrative entirely, claiming that this was an act of open warfare. Reporting from the time seems to back up the narrative to me that this was more of a violent street battle than a genocide. And that's a loaded term that I think should be used very carefully and exactly. There also doesn't seem to be any evidence that Aristide or his government directly ordered anything of the sort. In fact, at this point, he was frequently in the press calling for peace. Still, it would not shock me if there were actions of vigilante justice from pro-Lavalas gangs that killed some innocent people. Perhaps some of that did happen in Saint-Marc. What gets left out in the anti-Aristide telling of events like this is that these actions occurred during an open civil war with far-right paramilitaries. And Lavalas gangs, not armed or ordered by the president, were lashing out in response to the paramilitaries murdering their own friends and family. Now, of course, the taking of innocent life is tragic and an indefensible crime. But it's also what happens in war. And civil war in Haiti was exactly what the United States had been fomenting, and it's what they got. In January and February of 2004, the main force of the FLRN began advancing past the border of the Dominican Republic and into Haiti for their final assault. Now, there were only a few hundred of them, but they were armed with rocket launchers and assault rifles and they were experienced from years of training in the dissolved Haitian army or in the CIA-backed FROP military. A unit led by a former FROP officer quickly took over Cap-Haïtien, Haiti's second largest city outside of the capital region. The rebel forces there quickly rounded up prominent Lavalas activists and locked them in shipping containers. That is, the ones that they didn't execute outright. As small, heavily armed bands of FLRN rebels were advancing throughout the country and overtaking police who were either poorly equipped or unwilling to fight for Aristide, the president urged for calm and an end to threats of coup d'etat. And unfortunately for him, there wasn't much military assistance he could count on. Though Aristide had long insisted on Lavalas remaining a nonviolent movement, gangs in cities throughout Haiti sometimes had political affiliation for one party or another, and would occasionally fight rebel forces in defense of the government. But they usually did not have military-grade weapons. And what few national police units that did, such as the Presidential Guard or SWAT units, who had been on the CIA payroll, their loyalty was in question. That only left the option of intervention against the rebels from the U.S. or a U.N. peacekeeping force. But since the U.S. and most of the international community agreed to send a peacekeeping force if and only if Aristide made a bargain with Democratic Convergence that the opposition would accept, that option was off the table. In fact, by February of 2004, President Bush made it clear that he thought it was time for Aristide to step down to avert further bloodshed. Port-au-Prince was still under the government's control. But as FLRN forces took more and more territory, they grew closer to putting the capital under siege. Aristide still had the support of everyday people. But the everyday people did not have automatic weapons. The wealthy, and those armed by the United States and the Dominican Republic, did. Then, on February 28, 2004, Jean-Bertrand Aristide resigned. According to U.S. officials, Aristide reached out to the U.S. Embassy that night for asylum and safe travel out of the country. Ambassador James Foley said, quote, "We had not the slightest inkling that he would be prepared to leave on that day." The ambassador arranged for Aristide to be escorted to a plane by a troop of Marines and for the president to sign a letter authorizing a transfer of power. Aristide was then sent to Bangui in the Central African Republic after voluntarily, according to what the United States said, giving up power. But this is not how Aristide or his family and staff remember his resignation. According to the former president, it was more like an abduction. The evidence certainly makes it seem that way. For one, Aristide had gone on CNN just a few days before, insisting that he intended to serve out his term in office. Aristide's pilot and security advisor claimed that they were summoned in the middle of the night by U.S. Embassy officials and heavily armed American Special Forces. They were taken by complete surprise at Aristide's resignation. Aristide's wife, Mildred — Aristide had resigned from the priesthood years prior — was also shocked to hear that the family would be escorted out of the country. "Until the moment I was seated on the plane," said Mildred, "you never could have persuaded me that things would arrive at that point." Another detail that's off about the American account of Aristide voluntarily giving up office was the choice of the Central African Republic as the destination. At the time, the CAR was a dictatorship with close ties to France. As soon as Aristide landed, he was put under house arrest. U.S. officials explained this by saying that Aristide originally chose South Africa as his place of refuge, but the government there refused him, forcing the plane to land at the only other place in Africa that agreed to accept the former president. But the South African government, which at that time was one of the few nations still fully supportive of Aristide, claimed that this exchange never happened. In fact, Aristide was welcomed into South Africa just a few months after his resignation. Aristide even made the case that he was forced to resign on American news outlets, telling the Washington Post that American officials warned him if he refused to step down, thousands of civilians could die, all while surrounding the airport and presidential palace with U.S. soldiers. Said Aristide, quote, "I call it again and again a coup d'etat." He even gave an interview with Anderson Cooper, who asked him directly if he was made to resign by force. Aristide said very clearly that he was. The reaction from the Bush administration to this revelation from Aristide was blanket denial. "We did not force him onto the airplane. He went onto the airplane willingly, and that is the truth," said Secretary of State Colin Powell. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld even questioned that Aristide himself claimed he was forced to resign. Said Rumsfeld, quote, "I don't believe that he is claiming that. The idea that someone was abducted is just totally inconsistent with everything I heard or saw or am aware of. I do not believe he is saying what you are saying he is saying." What followed in the wake of Aristide's forced departure in 2004 was another occupation. First, a joint one by the U.S., Canada, and France, and then a U.N. peacekeeping force as part of a mission that remained in Haiti until 2017. Almost immediately after the president's resignation, rebel troops carried out reprisals against Lavalas supporters throughout the country. Again, like after the 1991 coup, thousands of civilians were killed, many even by UN peacekeeping forces as they raided still-resisting pro-Aristide neighborhoods. Exact estimates are impossible to come by, but one report from The Lancet found that there could have been up to 8,000 murders and 35 sexual assaults in Port-au-Prince alone from February 2004 to December 2005. The post-coup government was controlled entirely by the elite opposition to Aristide. An unelected council set up by the occupation forces selected Gérard Latortue as prime minister, a career diplomat who had secret ties to some of the rebel paramilitaries that took up arms against Aristide. Latortue had almost complete control of the country for 2 years, until elections in 2006 brought Aristide's old successor, René Préval, back into office. Aristide's old opponents did everything they could to delay the election, and when it happened, evidence surfaced that they attempted to cheat by stuffing ballot boxes or destroying ones in pro-Lavalas neighborhoods. Still, Préval won, proving that even after years of economic hardships, two coups, and a low-grade civil war, Aristide's movement still held sway over the everyday people of Haiti. Unfortunately, the coup of 2004 turned Fanmi Lavalas into a shadow of its former self. To this day, Aristide has retired from politics entirely, occasionally visiting his home country, but so far making good on his promise to never run for office again. Several popular leaders from the party were imprisoned or forced into exile, while some opted to collaborate with the coup regime to further their own careers. And of course, many grassroots activists in Lavalas were terrorized from participating further in politics, or they were outright killed. All of this was a result of a deliberate campaign of destabilization, carried out by the elite within Haiti, with economic and military support from larger nations, including Canada, France, and especially the United States. By using foreign aid as a weapon, the U.S. was able to cut off Haiti's development with an embargo as long as Aristide was president. And by providing arms and training to some of the most vengeful right-wing elements in the country, the CIA and U.S. State Department set the stage for a bloody civil conflict. Think tanks with ties to the U.S. government, like National Endowment for Democracy and the International Republican Institute, sent funding and support to a constellation of NGOs and opposition parties that had no intention of actually allowing the democratically elected president of Haiti to govern. Even when a U.S. intervention returned Aristide to power, we intentionally set him up to fail. And when he was elected by a wide margin, our government looked for every available excuse to set up roadblocks in his way and create an environment that would send Haiti into chaos. All of this, is because the Lavalas movement represents something that, just like in the 19th century, France and the United States in the 21st century cannot tolerate. And what that is the Haitian people who are free and independent. This has been a conspiracy you can believe in. Join me for the bonus episode, where I'll discuss more about what happened following the 2004 coup, plus more about U.S. intervention in Haiti following the 2010 earthquake. Thank you.